son is returned.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to further conversations and dialogues and learning what's necessary to invoke real change in my community and communities worldwide.
Welcome home, son. Welcome home. So to all of you who are out there listening, we thank you for listening. We thank you for the couple of calls that came in. And as John Lee Johnson used to say many years ago, stay out of trouble. But as Paul Muth likes to say, and I agree, get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you.
Welcome back to the North. We had some weather for you to enjoy. All right. Got some John Pilger at the end of this segment. Got Amy Goodman. Jeremy Scahill's back. I got his commentary. The Intercepted, I recommended. It's more just under 2 hours, so lots of good programming from Jeremy Scahill, who, if you don't know his name, he did the book The Dirty War, as well as the expose on Blackwater a while back. And he has a crew that does some really fun stuff, I think. Well, I don't know if fun's the right word. Entertaining. And we're going to check it out right now. And I'll be back with you with Amy Goodman's commentary, Scahill's. And, Drake on the passage of the 6-year extension of the surveillance bill that was just put in. We're talking about all the nonpartisan, the loggerheads at the Capitol, but they got together to give Trump and his FBI and other agencies unchecked power to surveil, it seems. That's what whistleblower Thomas Drake says. It's a tie to the local community here. He one of his whistleblowings was about SAIC's bloated trailblazer contract. SAIC, the corporation that you don't know about, probably, unless you work for it here in town. A lot of stuff there to unpack, but hang around and enjoy the mildness outside. Maybe you're on the podcast later. Got some Harry Shearer might work into some comedic moment if I need some relief. Look for events around town. I know there's some musical offerings that are intriguing to me, and maybe I'll give it a mention of them. But
racist person that you have ever met.
I am the least racist person.
They're bringing drugs. I don't care if the judge is Mexican or not. They're bringing crime, so I don't care about Mexican. They're rapists.
He's not from Mexico.
In my opinion,
he's from Indiana.
He is his Mexican heritage, and he's very proud of it.
And some, I assume, are good people.
If it were a Muslim judge, would you also feel like they wouldn't be able to treat you fairly?
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims.
It's possible, yes. Yeah, that would be possible, absolutely. It's really very curious as to what's going on with our president. Why doesn't he show the birth certificate? Maybe it says he's a Muslim.
Look at my African-American over here. Look at him.
I have a great relationship with the blacks.
Are you the greatest? You know what I'm talking about? Okay.
I've always had a great relationship with the blacks.
I love these guys. Look at these guys. Blacks for Trump. I love you.
A well-educated black has a tremendous advantage over a well-educated white. If I was starting off today, I would love to be a well-educated black.
How many of these people are even Indians to begin with? Because I've looked at them, and I have to tell you something, they don't look like Indians to me.
They don't look like Indians to me, and they don't look like the Indians. Now, maybe we say politically correct or not politically correct. They don't look like Indians to me, and they don't look like Indians to Indians. Although we have a representative in Congress who they say was here a long time ago. They call her Pocahontas. But you know what? I like you. Negotiating with China, they say, we want deal. He'd jump out of the seat.
I don't know anything about David Duke, okay?
I didn't even know he endorsed me.
White supremacy or white supremacist.
David Duke endorsed me? Okay.
You wouldn't want me to condemn a group that I know nothing about.
All right. I disavow, okay?
I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it, and you don't have any doubt about it either. But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now?
What's going on in Chicago?
He's fired. He's fired!
What the hell is going on? Of course I hate these people. And let's all hate these people, because maybe hate is what we need. Maybe hate is what we need.
Yes, sirree. There he is. We've got commentary from Scahill coming up, and if you listen in the past, he has what a friend of mine calls a potty mouth, and I usually bleep it, but I went through it, and the only things that I should probably delete or bleep are things that the POTUS said. It was the day after he had the film crew in, so he wasn't recording, apparently. Tell me that one of the senators wasn't running a audio recorder in their pocket. Oh, well. Amy Goodman's got a commentary about a pretty insidious aspect of the whole otherization of the quote-unquote illegals. It's actually a civil violation. It's not a criminal violation unless it's been passed in the various places. So, well, crazy things happening. Here's Amy's commentary, and then Thomas Drake. But we'll get to Scahill's commentary. I'll try to find some announcements. I'm going to use that I word again. I'm a bit impaired. I've got rotator cuff tear. It's beleaguering me. I think I did it in the pool by exercising too hard, so it wasn't a fall because I didn't have one. But anyway, that's enough about me. Here's Amy's Breaking the Sound Barrier with some difficult stuff to listen to, but I recommend it.
And our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. On Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, President Donald Trump visited his Trump International Golf Club in West Palm Beach, Florida, reportedly his 91st trip to a golf club since taking office. Meanwhile, in New York City, hundreds rallied in Judson Memorial Church demanding freedom for Gene Montreville and Ravi Ragbir, two men who had just been detained by ICE, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Both men have been in the U.S. for almost 60 years between them, and both are prominent immigrant rights organizers. They aren't the only ones who've been targeted by ICE lately either, suggesting a concerted effort by the Trump administration to round up leaders in the immigrant community. Gene Montreville, originally from Haiti, has been in the U.S. for over 30 years. Haiti's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere and is still recovering from the devastating 2010 earthquake that killed hundreds of thousands of people. It also is one of those countries that Trump reportedly singled out in a racist screed last Thursday, calling Haiti, El Salvador, and countries in Africa shitholes. The comment was made at the White House, where Trump and senators were discussing a possible legislative deal on immigrants. Why are we having all these people from shithole countries come here? Trump reportedly asked, adding, why do we need more Haitians? Take them out. He went on to say, we need more immigrants from places like Norway, one of the whitest countries on the planet. Gene Montreville, a well-known community leader in New York City, was indeed taken out.
I just had my first wake up in Haiti after 32 years.
That's Jean Montreville on the Democracy Now! NewsHour Wednesday morning, speaking from Haiti. He went on to describe his ordeal.
I was deported on Tuesday without any notification from my lawyer. They just deported me. My case was still in court. It was very tough. Two days of hell. Imagine staying up for 2 days straight with no food and shackled up. And with no explanation, and now I'm in Haiti.
Jean is a longtime volunteer with the New Sanctuary Coalition, a faith-based immigrant rights group headquartered at Judson Memorial Church. When asked if he thought that work contributed to his arrest and deportation, he said,
"But I can't regret the work that we did with the sexual movement, because no one knew about what ICE was doing until we started that movement."
Ravi Ragbir is the executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition. He was detained by ICE on January 11th, the same day Trump made his racist comments. Ravi's married to a U.S. citizen and is a nationally recognized leader in the immigrant rights community. Like Jean Montreville, Ravi was quickly flown by ICE in shackles to Miami. From the Chrome Detention Center, he managed to dictate a letter from an immigration jail, a missive inspired by the letter from Birmingham Jail, written by Martin Luther King Jr. in 1963. One of the speakers at the rally for Ravi Ragbir, Rhea Trivedi, a member of Ravi Ragbir's defense committee, read his letter.
"Every moment was uncertain except the certainty that they wanted me gone. At this moment, we need to speak about changing this system so that no one has to face this type of harm. Not just for me, but for all the families who face being torn apart. Until we get reform, we need to repeal the act that criminalizes immigrants, that makes us less than human because of a document."
Immediately after his detention, a protest formed outside the federal building in Manhattan. As Ravi was driven away in an ambulance, 18 people, including two New York City council members, were arrested while nonviolently attempting to stop it. Ravi was brought to the Chrome Detention Center in Florida, facing deportation to his native Trinidad. But after public outcry and a court challenge, ICE informed his lawyers he would be brought back to a detention jail in the New York City area. This is happening across the country. Colorado has more people living in sanctuary than any other state. Sandra Lopez is a Mexican mother of three who's been in the U.S. for 20 years. She's been living in the Unitarian Parsonage in Carbondale since October. Ingrid Latore re-entered sanctuary in Denver in October as well. On the day Ravi was detained, Ingrid's husband, Eliseo Jurado, was arrested by ICE in Colorado. In Seattle, I sent a notice to appear to Maru Mora Villalpando, who has lived in the United States for 25 years and leads the organization Northwest Detention Center Resistance.
ICE is really sending us a message to stop our political activity, to stop our activism. When I saw that letter, I immediately knew what it was, and I laughed to myself because I felt they're sending me a message. They want me to stop, and I want to stop.
That's Maru speaking to us on Democracy Now! But as evidenced by the enormous pressure on Congress to protect the 800,000 young immigrant dreamers living in the United States, a vigorous mass movement is growing, dedicated to immigrant rights that challenges mass deportations and the racism of President Trump and his supporters. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And there are a variety of events of that ilk. I see there's a shutdown the Trump Tower in Chicago tomorrow. There was a screening of Awake tomorrow, the film about Standing Rock, but it's down in Carbondale. So they also have a contingent going to Springfield. The ACLU just set out from Schnucks on the west end of town to drive to Springfield for a rally today. At Cranard Art, not the Art Museum, the Performing Arts Center, about 15 minutes ago, a 2 hours MLK commemoration began. So you can still catch part of that. I assume that there'll be listings on that for uh, Okay, I guess I have it here. Storyteller Don Blackman. Tell a personal historical story about Dr. King. There'll be some singing, of course, a choir dance performance with Dr. Kamal Nance. So, and the honoring of winners and honorary mention recipients of the MLK Creative Expressions Contest will be happening all this morning. So there's still time to get to part of that. Stage 5, that means it's out in the lobby. Good use of a great lobby, $1 million floor and all that. On Wednesday, somebody over at the law school invited Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart. Don't have any quotes from him, but I bet you there's some good ones. With the Trump Sessions Department of Injustice, as somebody's calling it here. There's a reception party probably outside. You can sneak in and get hors d'oeuvres. I've done it in the past when they had Co here. They call for a demonstration of concern for the downward spiral of human rights, both here and abroad, by the government of the elites. The abandonment of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. I guess Thomas Drake will be saying something about that in a later segment. Let's get to Jeremy Scahill's crafted commentary. And we'll check that out right now.
Are you racist? I am the least racist person that you have ever met. I am the least racist.
Humorous section.
Not they're rapists. Chicken heritage. And he's very proud of it.
I'm doing a talk under. Why aren't my headphones on? I didn't even notice. But, okay, did a few announces. I didn't mention a TJO, Trad Jazz Orchestra. Maybe they'll do Black and Blue for me. I haven't heard him play it in a while. It's a great tune with lyrics by a prince from Mozambique who came to the Harlem Renaissance and collaborated with Fats Waller on that tune. It's pretty brilliant. Here's Jeremy Scahill, I believe. We'll have, only have an excerpt of John Pilger. It's a long interview. I'll be playing probably more of that tomorrow, unless something else in the way of breaking news happens.
In New York City, and this is episode 40 of Intercepted.
That we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday is an important reminder that one of the defining characteristics of the American exceptionalism that Democratic and Republican politicians constantly mention is selective amnesia combined with historical revisionism. Dr. King, as he is celebrated in the U.S. by the majority of politicians and institutions, would be unrecognizable to King himself. King was a militant opponent of U.S. wars and militarism.
But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
Dr. King was a fierce advocate for the poor, the forgotten, the victims of the fabled American success story celebrated by its white beneficiaries. He repeatedly risked his life confronting not just racist policies or segregation, but the white supremacy ingrained in U.S. society to this very day. But King the radical, the anti-imperialist, the anti-racist, is not the King that's celebrated today.
The problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
The real Martin Luther King Jr., the king who J. Edgar Hoover tried to blackmail, wiretapped, and told King to kill himself, the king who described himself as a democratic socialist who believed in redistribution of wealth, the king who was assassinated, would today undoubtedly be labeled a black identity terrorist and shunned by the Republicans and Democrats alike for being too radical and anti-American. When King was gunned down, his popularity was at an all-time low. He had been largely abandoned by his friends in the civil rights movement and was regularly denounced in the papers and on radio and TV for being too radical.
Dr. King, former President Truman, was quoted by the AP as saying that the march from Selma, and this was his word, was silly and can't accomplish a darn thing except to attract attention. Now, there have been two murders, many beatings, and a federal expenditure for troops of about $300,000. Would you say that what the march accomplished was worth that cost?
Perhaps it's fitting that days before the King holiday, we learned that Donald Trump had called black nations shitholes or shithouses. It doesn't matter which. We see you, Trump. The Democrats expressed their outrage that the president would say such a thing. And Trump's defenders say it's the truth, regardless of what anyone thinks of his language. But here's what the Democrats and Republicans, and certainly Trump himself, will never, ever talk about. The U.S. role in destabilizing and mercilessly punishing the countries whose citizens Trump wants banned from coming to the U.S. or having protective status.
We will suspend the Syrian refugee program. Have no choice. And we will keep radical Islamic terrorists the hell out of our country. Believe me.
Take Haiti, the first black republic in the world, the first country in the Western Hemisphere to abolish slavery, a country consistently targeted by violent, anti-democratic U.S. policy ever since. Why don't we ever talk about the support that Ronald Reagan offered to the brutal dictatorship of Baby Doc, or how George H.W. Bush and the CIA unleashed murderous death squads in an effort to stop the democratic election of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, only to facilitate his overthrow in a brutal coup after Aristide won? Why don't we talk about how Bill Clinton would only allow Aristide to return to Haiti if he agreed not to seek re-election? Or the inhumane way that Clinton treated Haitians fleeing their country and warehoused them at the Guantanamo prison in appalling conditions before George Bush turned it into an illegal gulag for suspected terrorists?
I want to thank our partners in the hemisphere. When the United States decided that if necessary, we would use force to remove the military regime and to restore President Aristide and democracy, I was so determined that no one would think we were trying to revive any hemispheric imperialism.
Why don't we discuss the George W. Bush administration once again supporting the overthrow of Haiti's democratically elected government in 2004, or the neoliberal economic policies pushed by the Clinton Global Fund and the Obama administration, or the story of how President Obama backed the corrupt government in Haiti as it used corruption and anti-democratic tactics in an effort to keep power?
It's a great pleasure to welcome President Martelly of Haiti to the Oval Office. Our two countries really brought about the trend towards independence in the Western Hemisphere.
No Democrats or Republicans ever want to talk about this history. Yes, Donald Trump is a racist, a horrid, overt, shameless racist. But let's be honest, U.S. policy toward Haiti has always been racist. Trump should be condemned for what he said, but so too should all U.S. presidents going back well over a century who have ravaged Haiti in defense of corporate profits and the elite. On Martin Luther King Day, MSNBC repeatedly played a clip of Ronald Reagan denouncing the use of racial epithets in a speech that Reagan gave on King's birthday. And they contrasted that Reagan speech to Trump's shithole or shithouse comments.
As recent unfortunate events have demonstrated, we cannot be complacent about racism and bigotry. And I would challenge all of you to pledge yourselves to building an America where incidents of racial hatred do not happen, because racism has been banned not just from the law books, but from the hearts of the people.
So there you have it. Two presidents, two Republicans, two men claiming to be conservatives, and yet a great divide between race, even among two conservative Republican presidents. But after all these decades of progress, here we find ourselves with a reactionary, and yes, some would say a racist president.
The violent irony here, of course, is that Reagan is directly responsible for a tremendous amount of death and destruction in Haiti. And that little fact was not mentioned at all, because history doesn't matter to these people. Only empty platitudes gain bipartisan praise. Now, I could also talk about the role the U.S. has played in destroying Somalia and other African nations whose citizens Trump believes should be banned from coming to America. And it isn't just Haiti and African nations. Tens of thousands of people in El Salvador were mercilessly murdered, tortured, raped in the 1980s as Reagan poured U.S. weapons, training, and funding to a heinous military junta. That country has never fully recovered from what the U.S. did to it over a sustained period of time. Oh, and it wasn't just Salvadoran civilians who paid the price. Forces backed by Washington raped and murdered four American churchwomen. Archbishop Oscar Romero was shot dead as he performed mass. His killer was trained by the U.S. Six Jesuit priests were murdered in their home by paramilitaries backed by the U.S.
The priests were shown no mercy. During the night, gunmen invaded their dormitory, clubbed them, dragged them out to a lawn, and shot them. Two women caretakers were also murdered.
You see, no one wants to discuss this history when we try to understand why El Salvador faces the violence and poverty that make people want to flee. So yes, we should all be outraged at Trump's racist words and his racist policies. They're dangerous and vile, but they don't exist in a vacuum. It's the U.S. that's been the shithole or the shithouse in countries the world over. It's a legacy of racism built by Democrats and Republicans. And Donald Trump is a fitting person to now represent that legacy, because his overt racist rhetoric matches this racist legacy that no one ever wants to talk about. Okay, let's get on with the show.
Well spoken. He had a good holiday, came back and did an interview bonus with James Risen, who just joined The Intercept. He's the journalist that had his story suppressed just before the Bush 2 second election about... is it Stellar Wind? I believe so. And that's what Drake is talking about in the joint efforts of the parties, something they got together on, giving the DOJ more power for surveillance of American citizens and American residents, actually. The Constitution protects people that are living here as well. What an archaic notion. Just had another announcement brought to my attention. This is January 27th, so it's a ways away. The Prairie Group of the Sierra Club is doing a political field team training people to work for electoral systems. Alice Engelbright. Bretson is the organizer. There's supposed to be people down from Chicago and maybe Springfield. Just got a text from someone who's driving over. She's got to catch up with the ACLU contingent that just went out, and that's about the Women's March. Only a half hour left, and the Drake piece is, how long is it? So we'll just get a taste of John Pilger. I'm hoping to play more of that tomorrow. He just had an honor. I never heard of it, but he put all of his writings on a hard drive, and it's in the British Library now, and they chose him to archive. He doesn't get a lot of play here in the U.S., but one thing I can commend to your attention, and it might explain why maybe the Australian left has a different point of view about our surveillance and national security state, is the Gough Whitlam constitutional quote-unquote coup, where the Governor General dissolved the Labour Party government in a way that brought back the Conservative Party in Australia. This is in the, I believe, early 70s. And some Australians remember that. It isn't just the darker nations, as Vijay Prashad calls it, that were suffered the depredations of the U.S. National security malfeasance, as it were. I think, Intercepted has a, we're going to the Flashpoint segment, but Intercepted has a piece on with a variety of, like I said, it's about an hour and 47 minutes long. Got to hear is John Cypher, ex-CIA operative, and Marcy Wheeler of Empty Wheel. Empty Wheel does really great work. She's a little. They're going to talk about Russia investigation and the Steele dossier. And I have to hear that because I've been critical of the credulity that we're giving to the aforementioned national security state, CIA, NSA, and all those 17 intelligence agencies we seem to have. Interviews Tulsi Gabbard about U.S. regime change in North Korea and a variety of issues. She's a representative from Hawaii and apparently was the person that tweeted out first that it was a false alarm, this ballistic missile attack thing that happened the beginning of the week. She beat the state agency by something like 20 minutes, tweeted out that it was a false alarm, only about 12 or 13 minutes after it went out. So she seems to be well connected to the somebody there. Interview that I heard part of, leading Marxist scholar David Harvey, who is by academic discipline a geographer, but he's got a major book out on neoliberalism. So I'm commending your attention to The Intercepted. But now we're going to Flashpoints, and this is about what they did agree on at Capitol Hill. The necessity of expanding national security powers and surveillance. He beat the rap that NSA put up against him. DOJ prosecuted him. He whistle-blew about a number of things. But I think one of the things that got him in trouble was he tangled with a large corporate entity called SAIC, Scientific Applications in International Computing, which began here at the U of I at Champaign-Urbana, if I recall. Their major node now is San Diego, but they have pretty big facility out at the Research Park on South Campus, multiply cited in the great book Spies for Hire about the whole privatization of intelligence, quote-unquote, I'm forgetting him. He's great on Korea as well. I'll remember it later. It's one of those escalier moments. But here's Dennis Bernstein and Randy Credico, who is an odd fellow if there ever is one. He's been championing Julian Assange in an unalloyed way. I have some alloys in my championship. But Thomas Drake, whistleblower for the NSA, talking about the surveillance situation. They get into some other things. Maybe I'll play it. Maybe I will go to John Pilger instead from the same segment of, I believe it was Tuesday, Flashpoints. Find it at flashpoints.net is the easiest way to archive it. Get to the archive, it seems to me now, with my devices anyway.
NSA whistleblower blew the whistle on Stellar Wind, has been watching privacy, the rights to privacy to Americans and folks around the world disappear in the name of national security, has been very courageous blowing the whistle. I know, Thomas Drake, you were not happy to see that 60 senators with the help of Democrats vote to cut off the debate and give Trump more surveillance power. Do you want to remind us where this started in terms of your whistleblowing with the earlier program, Stellar Wind, and what the significance of yesterday's vote was? Thanks, of course, to the Democrats. Couldn't happen without them.
Yeah, and the vote today to actually pass,
they did it, right.
The FISA Reauthorization Act, it's the third iteration of it. It actually expands the first two iterations, interestingly enough. But the original foundational programs for this began right after 9/11 in the deepest of national level state secrecy. It was approved and authorized by President Bush in the week shortly after 9/11, and I became aware just after 9/11 about the verbal authorizations that are being given for NSA to turn its extraordinarily vast powers on the United States itself. Because of the failure of 9/11, the failure to keep people out of harm's way, and almost 3,000 people were actually murdered that day. So as a result of the failure to keep people out of harm's way, and under the preamble of the Constitution to provide for the common defense, that failure, and this is sort of the paradox of secret power, was here's our, you know, they never let a good crisis go to waste, as a certain former chief of staff said in the Obama administration. Never let a good crisis go to waste. So an extraordinary decision was made, a strategic decision with enormous consequences, to subvert the Constitution, effectively a silent coup against the Constitution, and set it aside, including the Fourth Amendment, completely violate the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and simply give enormous power to NSA to turn its vast apparatus, its normally forward facing in terms of foreign intelligence, and begin to use it to acquire the communications, the vast electronic communications within the United States. That all began right after 9/11 and quickly metastasized over the years. It was an extraordinarily far-reaching program. The full nature of it, we still do not completely know to this day. And it existed in the deepest of the national security state bowels, with only just a small number of people actually knowing about it, for about four-plus years, until the New York Times article, which had been withheld for 14 months, came out in December of 2005, revealing for the first time the existence of what was then referred to as the warrantless wiretapping program. That program, once it came out, the government went apoplectic, and I ultimately was caught up as the target of that investigation, subsequently was charged with espionage, primarily to punish me, and punish me good, for having blown the whistle within the government on this extraordinarily unconstitutional program, as well as ultimately going to the press with unclassified information regarding this, as well as other wrongdoing by the government, including the 9/11 intelligence failures. So they had to put the secret genie back in the box. And what they ended up doing, starting with the Protect America Act, after they did some shenanigans with a secret FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, again, by the way, created 1978, signed into law by President Carter, specifically to deal with the extraordinary abuse of power in the preceding decades that all came out in the 1970s. And so they ended up passing what was called the FISA Amendments Act in 2008. It was reauthorized in 2012 without any changes at all. And then it just came up again here and is now, no doubt, will be renewed. Trump has already indicated he'll sign it for another 6 years, taking us through 2024. And it turns even the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act on its head, because instead of it being, you know, the government always had carte blanche, it did for decades, even during the Cold War, and even post-Cold War, to go after legitimate, you know, foreign intelligence threats and foreign intelligence targets. In this case, the claim is made that Section 702 and the FISA Reauthorization Act, as they call it, is designed to only go after foreign targets. That is absolutely not true. And in fact, it sweeps up extraordinary amounts of information and data about Americans without a warrant.
Wow.
And ironically enough, it even gives, under the expanded version, it gives criminals more rights than it does suspicion-free Americans.
How so?
And people living and people living in the United States, not just Americans, but, you know, legal visitors, you know, resident aliens, etc., who happen to be in the United States. And so here we are. You know, here we are. What, 16 plus years after 9/11, and this simply is increasing the normalization of this, what I've, you know, we call it the surveillance panopticon.
Amazing. Listening to a special edition of Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein here with Randy Credico live on the fly.
Thank you, Dennis. This is Randy Credico here. We are speaking with Thomas Drake, who spent 12 years in the Air Force and intelligence, and I think 10 or 12 years, and then another 10 or 12 years with the NSA, and is a whistleblower. He is the recipient of the prestigious Sam Adams Award. Thomas Drake, I'm looking at these names. We spoke earlier today of Democrats. Yeah. Democrats, Tom Carper from Delaware, these are northern states, Bob Casper from Pennsylvania, we have Catherine Cortez from Nevada, not a northern state, but you have from Illinois, you have Tammy Duckworth, you have two senators from Rhode Island that supported this. So why would someone like me, you know, I'm very upset with the direction of the Republican Party, but why would I, and the new Democrat, Doug Jones, just signed on to this. Mark Warner, of course, from Virginia. Why would I want to support Democrats in 2018? And shouldn't this be an issue?
It should be, but essentially they're betting that most Americans don't care. They believe that most Americans believe that they're doing what they're supposed to do, which is, you know, keep America safe from threats. And, hey, if they, you know, whatever powers they need to keep us safe, hey, you know, if it happened to, quote-unquote, incidentally or accidentally or inadvertently sweep up some of my communications, hey, I've done nothing wrong, so I got nothing to worry about. Leaving aside for the moment that somehow, you know, liberty and security are mutually exclusive. And so if you have a choice, then, of course, you're going to pick security every single time in sacrificing liberty in the process. This is a bipartisan agreement. It's deeply embedded. Who's going to stand in the way of national security? It's really become a state religion. If you invoke national security and, you know, almost religious tones, then you bow down before that altar, and you're not going to get in the way of it because the fear mongering is going to be rolling out. You know, and they're going to, you know, there are those who are going to say, hey, if you vote against this, then, you know, the blood will be on your hands. That's sort of the in some cases, the direct and indirect threat. So they vote for it, right? And the military-industrial intelligence complex is something that Eisenhower warned us about in his farewell address before the Camelot era and President Kennedy came into office. You know, he realized that it would become deeply embedded in the government. He was extremely alarmed about what this would mean for the future of the republic. And, you know, here we are. We had the seminal event of 9/11, and this is just the continuance of what I've referred to as the golden age of surveillance. So it doesn't matter whether you're Democrat or Republican. I mean, both the cloture vote and as well as the vote in the Senate, it's the Democrats that put it over the top. Let's get real, right? You knew that a lot of the Republicans, although many of them actually voted against it, it was the Democrats that put them over the top. So, you know, here we are once again, and Section 702 is being claimed as one of the great, you know, one of the greatest tools that the government has to fight terrorism. And of course, you know, that's an undeclared war, a war of indeterminate length, and we've spent, you know, trillions of dollars since 9/11 dealing with it. So it's made a lot of people rich, and you've got a lot of businesses and companies who obviously lobbied quite heavily and quite strenuously. And, you know, why you know, you're not gonna overcook the goose that keeps laying the golden egg. You're just definitely make sure you take care of that goose because it keeps laying those wonderful eggs. And that's why I call it the golden age of surveillance. You know, there's more than enough money to go around for everybody. It's a growth industry.
Thomas Drake. It was Tim Shorrock that covers SAIC very carefully, something like 60 or 70 citations in the index, and they probably were lobbying. I'm sure they have myriad lobbies. $9 billion, and that was some years ago, was the extent of their contracts with the U.S. government. They have maybe 10% other activities, which included command and control for petroleum refineries and pipeline distribution. And they apparently participated in one of the coups against Chavez in Venezuela by sabotaging the hardware and software that the Petrovez was relying on to run the refineries, etc. Interesting sidelight. to their activities. Again, that was from, I think, Tuesday, because that's when the vote was, the day after. And unison was found, though, actually. As they pointed out, there were some libertarian Republicans that voted against the revival of the Patriot Act. Six more years. John Pilger was on the same episode, as I mentioned at the top, and I think they talk about this. I should have edited this a little better. The whole segment is about 45 minutes long. We won't be hearing that, but we'll just hear the 15 minutes that I did edit it in. I believe it's from the beginning. Looking to play more of this tomorrow. I hope we get the section about the Post. I think we do. That's kind of what I wanted to highlight. Lionizing Katherine Graham, whereas her quote about cooperating with the intelligence agencies to keep some information away from the American people. They don't need to know. It's better that way. Something else that comes to mind about Pilger is that it's his quote of Ed Lansdale, who was the character that sort of inspired The Quiet American, Vietnam novel written by Graham Greene. I confess I didn't read it. Maybe that would be a good late winter read. There's a book out by Max Boot, Lionizing That Guy, which is pretty amazing. The quote I'm thinking of has to do with needing to exterminate resistance if they're intransigent in third world countries. Max Boot sort of makes him out as some kind of a diplomat. The road not taken, he says, we could have won Vietnam, and all that crap. But Pilger brought it to my attention, and I did find it. Searching for it is not easy to find, that quote from Lansdale, actually. It was written up in an article by Dennis Bernstein in Consortium News, so there is a way to find it on the web. But one of those prop or not websites.
And I'm pleased about that, because it means that online, through the wonders of the digital age, in this great repository of historical documents and contemporary documents, people can access, and I can access when I forget what I wrote in 1975.
Yes.
What did I write? Yeah. So there it is.
So you can know it, yeah, just in case if when people accuse you of something, see if they're telling the truth or lying.
That's right.
But anyway, I do. I want to read just a little bit of what they say in welcoming your material into the library. There's a lot I could read, but just let me say, it says, throughout his career, John Pilger has demonstrated the power and significance of investigative journalism in uncovering stories of peoples who have been ignored by the mainstream media or left otherwise without voice. His groundbreaking work in Cambodia revealed the devastation caused by the Khmer Rouge, and his film Year Zero, The Silent Death of Cambodia, has subsequently been described as one of the 10 most influential documentaries of the 20th century. And you are top of the line, John Pilger, in terms of being one of the, if not the most influential documentarian of the 20th and 21st century. So we are honored to have you with us. I want to sort of jump into today's material and read a little bit of the statement that you sent to the, I think it was the World Socialist Conference, where they were doing a webinar to deal with the deep nature of censorship. And you wrote just a little bit here. Something has changed. Although the media was always a loose extension of capital power, it is now almost fully integrated. Dissent, once tolerated in the mainstream, has regressed to a metaphoric underground as liberal capitalism moves towards a form of corporate dictatorship. leadership. I mean, that is really what is going on. It's shocking and it's terrifying, and it's getting worse at an exponential rate, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I do. And that conference, the discussion between David North and Chris Hedges himself was a good example of that. He was right from within the mainstream, New York Times foreign correspondent, and now finds himself outside it. Another example is America's most celebrated investigative journalist, Seymour Hersh. It appears can only get published in Germany. And it was, I think, Der Spiegel. I'm pretty sure that's right.
London Review of Books, I think, has been putting out some of his pieces too, if you can believe that.
But he's lost his place on the New York. He effectively has been ejected from the mainstream in the United States. In my own case, I navigated my way through the mainstream. All my films, for example, are still shown on the ITV network in Britain, a commercial network, but my written journalism is no longer welcome. Probably its last home was The Guardian, which 3 years ago got rid of people like me and others in pretty much a purge of those who really were saying what The Guardian no longer says anymore. That has happened right across the liberal media. I mean, we know about the overtly right-wing media, but I mean, the Washington Post is a very good example, and as there seems to be a lot of celebration in London at the moment about the arrival of a film called The Post, which I've seen and is good in parts and very bad in other parts, the Washington Post, the source of Watergate expose, now owned by the man who the other day was declared the richest human being, Jeff Bezos, with a net worth of $105 billion, and with seven other billionaires, apparently has a collective net worth equal to that of the poorest 3.5 billion people on Earth. That kind of grotesque demography, if that's the right word, really says so much about the dark period that we are entering, which has already excluded many of the voices in the formerly mainstream media, many of the voices that would warn against it. I mean, the Washington Post itself is the notorious source of, as you'll remember, the a site called, the full name was Propaganda or Not. No one had ever heard of it, but it listed some of the very best and distinguished dissenting sites in the United States, including Consortium News, World Socialist Website, Black Agenda Report, and Counterpunch, and others. It listed them as sources of Russian propaganda. Really outrageous McCarthyism in the Washington Post, which is at the moment going through a period of extreme self-aggrandizement via Hollywood yet again. That's what I mean when I, as an example, as a vivid example of true dissenting journalism, now a metaphoric underground. I don't regard your program and Randy's program, when he had his program on WBAI, and should still have it, as an underground. It's a source of dissenting views of real truth and information. But it's forcing all of us into this margin when really the mainstream is in the margin and the extreme, the margin, is in the mainstream, if that makes sense.
It does, and I want to, and just to sort of leap off into the area that Randy has devoted the last 2 years of his life to, that's reporting about perhaps one of the most important publishers working today, that would be Julian Assange. Do you want to talk about his work in the context of what you're talking about in terms of censorship? Yes. And the importance of alternatives to this corporate censorship machine?
Yes. Julian Assange has borne the brunt personally of much of this historic shift, the brutal edge of it, because he and his organization, WikiLeaks, have exposed so much of it. They've revealed it. And that's unforgivable. There's no doubt that what WikiLeaks has done is the most important, probably the most important disclosure journalism of most of my lifetime. And it's worldwide. There are the famous revelations, of course, the Iraq warlogs, the Afghan warlogs, the various democratic cables, and so on. But it applies in country after country where politicians who have been deceiving the public in their public utterances have been caught out by the revelations of WikiLeaks, which have served the people, which have informed the people. That's happened from down here in the Antipodes in Australia right through to the Nordic countries. It's an extraordinary, quite an epic achievement. And, of course, it's not without cost, personally, to Assange, who was set up, as we now know, the withdrawal of this disgraceful Swedish campaign, that's all it was, against him was delayed. It should have happened years ago. It was delayed because he was set up. We don't have to go into all the details, but the anger directed at him, interestingly, from those in the media themselves, many people, many of them I know, who have really been shamed by WikiLeaks, because what WikiLeaks did was do the job that journalists ought to have been doing for many, many years. That's what Daniel Ellsberg did years ago, and people understood it then.
And he's on a book tour, Daniel Ellsberg is. That's John Pilger, talking from, as he put it, the Antipodes. He's an Australian, but I think he mainly lives in London. Pilger. I mentioned the article, perhaps not when I started this, but earlier in the segment. He wrote an article in October of 2014, The Forgotten Coup, How American Britain Can Crush the Government of Their Ally, Australia. CIA helped manipulate the search circumstance to get a Labour minister out, who had the temerity to say he didn't want the CIA listening station in his country anymore, among other things. Makes the Australians from down under look a little differently at our national security state, it seems to me. Opinions you hear here are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. That's from Flashpoints. You can find it at flashpoints.net. Also on SoundCloud. AudioPort should be there too, but so should have Behind the News, which I'm about to start up. But it wasn't there, so I got it directly from Behind the News website. Doug Henwood on board with some interesting material that I've already disposed of on this browser. John Pilger says you can view all of his films. He's been making them since he was a stringer for an Australian